Coming up on Fronteras, the undocumented family members of military personnel will have an easier time gaining legal status thanks to a new Obama administration policy. But at the same time, military branches are rejecting applicants who have dependents without papers.
I think it's up to the Pentagon to quickly correct this error.
The hurdles that remain for mixed status families in the military. Migrants arrested in the Arizona desert say Border Patrol detention cells are dangerously cold. So cold, there's a nickname for them, the freezers.
To subject people to this kind of mistreatment for any period of time is unacceptable.
An investigation into cold storage by the Fronteras Desk and the Center for Investigative Reporting. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. The Obama administration recently announced a major change to immigration policy with regards to the military. Now, military spouses and children who are in the country illegally can stay here without fear of deportation and work towards permanent legal status. But as Jude Joffe Block reports, this new policy appears contradictory to an increasingly common practice in many branches of the military, a practice that explicitly bans enlistment by people who have undocumented dependents. From the Fronteras Desk in Phoenix, Jude Joffe Block reports.
Earlier this month, Margaret Stock, an immigration lawyer and a military expert, got a call from a client.
He's quite upset because he was planning to join the military and he can't provide the proof of his wife's status that the recruiter is demanding he provide.
Stock has been getting more of these calls from military applicants who are married to immigrants without papers. And they all have the same refrain.
He's being told he's not allowed to enlist.
This policy appears to have been in place for the Navy, Marine Corps, and Army for the past 3 or 4 years. Stock finds it surprising, though, because during the same period, federal immigration officials have been working out a seemingly contradictory policy to help the unauthorized immigrant spouses and children of service members remain in the country legally. That was the policy formalized in a memo last week.
That program obviates the need for any bar to enlistment. So it doesn't make any sense for them to be enforcing this rule now. It's almost as though the people doing this don't understand what's been going on out there.
Kathleen Welker, a spokeswoman for the Army Recruiting Command, confirmed the Army enlistment policy.
When an applicant shows that his dependents or her dependents do not have proper documentation, that's a red flag to a recruiter that the applicant is, in this case, harboring an illegal alien.
Welker says the reasoning is based on a federal statute that makes it a crime to harbor or conceal someone who's in the country illegally.
And that means that the applicant then is breaking the law and may be subject to arrest. Well, that's not what we're about in the U.S. Army.
The harboring statute she's referencing was written over 50 years ago, and that interpretation of it is controversial.
That is a totally untenable reading of the law. It's just wrong.
Omar Jadwat is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrant Rights Project.
Multiple federal courts of appeals have specifically rejected the notion that cohabitation with somebody who lacks immigration status is harboring.
In fact, a spokesperson for Immigration and Customs Enforcement said the agency itself doesn't enforce the harboring statute to arrest relatives of unauthorized immigrants unless there's some other criminal activity.
I think it's up to the Pentagon to quickly correct this error.
Enlistment policies are up to each branch, according to the Department of Defense. Meanwhile, service members who make it into the military and later marry a spouse without papers can also face problems. We spoke with one American in the U.S. Coast Guard who asked to stay anonymous to not jeopardize his military career. He enlisted when he was 18 and then married a Central American woman who didn't have papers.
But I was under the impression when a U.S. citizen marries anybody, you know, they would automatically get their, you know, their residence card.
Instead, his wife was potentially subject to a 10-year bar from the U.S. if she tried to legalize. In the meantime, he lost his security clearance. The reason? He hadn't done enough to resolve his wife's immigration status, thereby participating in her illegal activity.
I felt bad. I don't feel right, you know. In some ways, it's sort of like discrimination, you know.
Without security clearance, he couldn't do the job he was trained to do.
There was lawyers that I went and saw told me, well, if you want your security clearance back, you have to get divorced. You know, I'm not going to get divorced.
Recently, his wife got a work permit and permission to be in the country through an earlier phase of the policy for military families that was formalized last week. But this man doesn't expect to get his security clearance back until she gets a green card, months or years from now. In the meantime, he wonders how much diversity and talent the military is losing by banning future applicants with mixed-status families like his. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
It's been 5 years since the Navajo Nation opened its first casino. For 2 decades, the tribe resisted the lure of the quick moneymaker. They feared the social ills that tend to come with gaming: compulsive gambling, alcoholism, crime, and loss of culture. From the Changing America desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales takes a look at gaming's impacts on the Navajo tribe.
In the not-too-distant past, people driving Interstate 40 through northern Arizona may have noticed the two giant red arrows that appear to be shot into the ground, and not much else. Travelers now whizzing by Twin Arrows can't miss the giant lit-up sign inviting them into the Navajo Nation's newest casino. On that side of the highway, the arrows point toward the sky. That's the direction CEO Derek Watchman says the casinos can take the tribe's economy.
Last year, across the country, Indian gaming had roughly $27 billion in revenue, creating thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs.
About half of the Navajo Nation is unemployed. Many people live without electricity and indoor plumbing, isolated on dirt roads. So stepping out of the outhouses and tumbleweeds and into the glittering new casino resort, you can't help but notice a disparity. The Navajo Nation Gaming Enterprise is trying to do something about that. It's created more than 1,300 jobs of various pay scales. 80% of those employees are Navajo, including manager Kenneth Johnson.
This is all our carnival games, blackjack, Spanish 21. People can come in and play. Minimum bet, $5 to $200.
It's obvious Johnson is proud to work here. He points out the many cultural symbols, some subtle in the shade of wallpaper or face on the poker chip, some not so subtle. On the screens above the slot machines, you can watch an animated film that illustrates the tribe's creation story.
So you have the different elements depicted. You have earth, fire, water, and wind. So he's giving the gifts to First Man and First Woman.
There's a clear effort to hold on to the tribe's roots and inform visitors. About 65% of the patrons at Twin Arrows are non-native. At the tribe's three other casinos in New Mexico, more Navajos are spending money. While no alcohol is allowed on the reservation, the tribe decided to make an exception at its casinos to stay competitive. And they've paid the price. The average number of public intoxication arrests are up 77% in Church Rock, New Mexico, since the first casino opened there, according to tribal police records. Ernie Zah is a spokesman for the Navajo president.
It's not as concrete or it's not as black and white as because of the casino there's that many more incidents. That's part of it. But the other part is we also have 4 more officers in the community of Church Rock. And that alone brings more law presence to that community.
Zah says the tribe plans to have more officers stationed at the new casino as well. Catherine Rand researches tribal gaming policy at the University of North Dakota.
Economic development comes with costs. And particularly economic development based on gambling can come with costs.
But historically, Rand says, the economic development options available to tribes have been incredibly limited.
Not just by where reservations are located, but by lack of market, by lack of a taxable land base, by reservation communities that are already struggling with some of the most dire socioeconomic circumstances in our nation.
So since the federal government passed the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act in the late 80s, casinos have become a viable way for tribes to jumpstart their economies. But Rand says the most successful tribes use the casinos as a launching pad to diversify. The Navajo Nation recently announced plans to do just that and build an outlet mall, RV park, and entertainment complex next to the Twin Arrows Casino. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. Migrants arrested in the Arizona desert say Border Patrol detention cells are dangerously cold. So cold, there's a nickname for them, the freezers.
To subject people to this kind of mistreatment for any period of time is unacceptable.
Investigation into cold storage by the Fronteras Desk and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. As the nation remembers the last tragic day of John F. Kennedy's presidency, many Latino voters of that era reflect on what the 35th president meant to their emerging political bloc. As David Martin Davies reports, JFK had a special connection to the Mexican-American voter, and his campaign helped create the Latino Democratic political coalition that still exists today.
It was the night before President John F. Kennedy's fateful trip to Dallas, and he was in Houston. He had received an invitation to stop by the banquet for the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC. In his first 3 years at the White House, Kennedy had declined invitations from LULAC and other Latino civil rights organizations, but this time was different.
This organization has done a good deal for this state and for our country.
Kennedy's appearance at the Rice Ballroom in Houston is considered the first time that a sitting president officially acknowledged Latinos as an important voting bloc. Benny Martinez was there that night.
The crowd there was, I'm sure, over capacity. When he walked into our banquet, everybody went wild, hollering, Viva Kennedy, Viva Kennedy.
The phrase Viva Kennedy was a salute and a reminder to JFK of how the Latino vote turned out for him in droves in his 1960 presidential election. Viva Kennedy clubs sprung up across the Southwest in Mexican-American neighborhoods and mounted an unprecedented voter registration effort and get-out-the-vote campaign for Latino voters. Kennedy's wife, Jacqueline, was drafted to appear in a television campaign ad speaking Spanish.
Voten ustedes por el Partido Demócrata el día 8 de noviembre. Que viva Kennedy.
Even though Kennedy was from the Northeast and born to wealth and privilege, Martinez said there was a connection with the Mexican-American community.
We were both Catholics, and we liked the man.
The Latino vote was critical for Kennedy's presidential election victory. On Election Day 1960, Kennedy won 85% of the Mexican-American vote. In Texas, where he lost the Anglo vote, JFK won 91% of the Latino vote, delivering the state's electoral votes and the White House. Mexican-American voters in New Mexico also made the difference for JFK. The Viva Kennedy clubs delivered, and they wanted in return appointments for Latinos to high-ranking civil service jobs, federal judgeships, and civil rights reforms.
One of the things that we were working against was a poll tax, because back then you had to pay $1.50 to get your poll tax in January to be able to vote.
But historian Ignacio M. Garcia said Kennedy did not deliver for Latinos.
He never quite got to the nitty-gritty. He never developed like Robert Kennedy, who would become a good friend of Cesar Chavez, or Edward Kennedy, probably the best Kennedy friend that Latinos ever had.
Garcia said the candidate that the Viva Kennedy Club supported never really existed, that Kennedy was a useful invention for the fledgling national Latino vote.
The Kennedy mystique allows them to create an agenda for their community, a national agenda. The Mexican Americans didn't see themselves as a national community. So Kennedy is very useful as that kind of tool.
But that night in Houston, Kennedy appeared to have understood that he needed to start fulfilling his promises to his Latino voters. And if he was going to win re-election, he would have to reignite the enthusiasm of the Viva Kennedy clubs. But 15 hours after the historic meeting, Kennedy was dead. However, the torch was passed to Lyndon Johnson, who did make good on making minority appointments and civil rights laws. And Johnson enjoyed support from Hispanic voters who helped him during his landslide victory of 1964. David Martin Davies reporting.
A detention cell is not designed to be comfortable, but human rights groups and migrants who've crossed illegally into the United States say the conditions inside some U.S. Border Patrol stations have become unsafe. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Fronteras desk, Peter O'Dowd explains temperatures in some detention cells from Texas to Arizona are so low that migrants say it's a form of punishment to keep them from crossing again.
It's breakfast time at a food bank near the border in Nogales, Mexico.
Padre nuestro, que estás en el cielo.
On this November morning, about 30 recent deportees gather here for prayer.
¿Cuántas personas sintieron frío cuando estaban con la patrulla fronteriza? ¿Se puede levantar la mano?
Before they eat, an employee asks, how many people felt cold when they were with Border Patrol? Raise your hand.
Todos.
Todos, they say. Nearly every hand goes up. This is among the most common complaints when migrants at many points along the southern border are released from U.S. detention. Take Alexi Luis Lopez and his 16-year-old brother, Brian. When agents arrested them in the Arizona desert, they spent 48 hours in custody before getting deported.
Pues éramos varios de los que estábamos ahí dentro, nos juntamos y empezamos a abrazarnos para que nos calentáramos el cuerpo.
There were a lot of us in the cells, Brian remembers. To stay warm, we huddled together. Alexi says the agents took his sweater and left him with a T-shirt. Through an interpreter, Alexi says soon after his arrest, he told an agent he was cold.
And he said that maybe we would think about it two times before trying to cross again.
Door one!
To see for myself how cold it is inside these stations, I met Border Patrol agent Andy Adame. About 65 people move through this station in Nogales, Arizona, each day. Adame says within 12 to 16 hours, they're booked and sent on to Tucson, where the deportation process continues. Through a window, I see a line of men trying to sleep on a metal bench. They're covered with what looks like a thin sheet of tin foil. Adame opens the cell door and walks inside.
You know, they're all given these solar blankets when they first walk in. Here's a box of them right outside the door.
Adame says the agency once used cloth blankets, but they were too hard to clean.
You see them covered up, so I guess it is a little chilly in here. It's not overly cold, but they are using the blankets.
I'm sorry?
Hace frío.
A man pokes his head out from the foil. Hace frío, he says. It's cold.
Well, we've given them two or three blankets. You know, all they got to do is tell the officers and we'll give them another blanket.
Adame gives the man two small packages, extra sheets of foil. And the room does feel cold. We leave the cell looking for a thermostat. There's some confusion about where it's kept. And about 5 minutes later, we find a row of them inside the station's control room. The thermostat says 70 degrees.
We have never had somebody, get sick on us because it's too cold in here. You know, we try to keep it just a little cool just to keep down, the spreading of disease in there.
But human rights groups say cold rooms have become a widespread practice across the border.
To subject people to this kind of mistreatment for any period of time is unacceptable.
James Lyle is an ACLU attorney in Tucson.
But to do so for sometimes days is really egregious.
Now, the legal battle has started. Earlier this year, the group Americans for Immigrant Justice filed complaints on behalf of detainees held in South Texas. Court documents claim the detainees suffered psychological harm and came down with physical illnesses associated with exposure to the cold, lack of sleep, and inadequate access to food, water, and toilets. These documents claim border agents routinely refer to the cells as las hieleras, or the freezers. Border Patrol denied a request to visit a Texas station, and agents deny using the term. This border crossing near Progreso, Texas, is on the front line of the battle over illegal immigration. With stepped-up border security in places like Arizona, the migrants have moved east. Now, up to 800 people a day crowd into a single South Texas border station, according to Christopher Cabrera, He's an agent and union leader for the Rio Grande Valley chapter of the National Border Patrol Council.
Sometimes they just pile up and pile up, and we put the bodies where we can.
Cabrera says people crowded into cells share two toilets. The air is dusty and stale. He says some migrants are stuck in short-term detention for days at a time, far longer than the agency's policy of 12 hours to move people through the system. As for the cold?
Where we're at, it's the exact opposite. Well, the air conditions can't keep up with the amount of people that are in there based on the body heat, so the air condition seizes up.
Yet that's not what some migrants report.
Estamos hablando de temperatura, que uno tiembla del frío.
We agreed not to use this woman's name because she's afraid of retribution in her native El Salvador. She claims the Texas cells were ice cold, the temperatures at the nearby station in McAllen so low that her fingers turned purple.
Para que tú firmes tu deportación o te desesperes por el frío.
She echoes a common claim of many deportees. They keep it so cold you'll sign your deportation papers and give up hope, she says. Some people can't stand it. They ask to sign so they can go back to their country. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
This story was co-reported by the Center for Investigative Reporting's Rachel Bale. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KNAU Flagstaff, KRWG Las Cruces, KNPR Las Vegas, KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KUAZ Tucson, KXWT West Texas Public Radio, KRTS Marfa, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. Find us on Facebook and join the conversations there. For the latest headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our main handle is at fronterasdesk. You may subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.